This week we are seeing the release of Jurassic World. I think it opens in cinemas tomorrow. Certainly there's a preview of it tonight. But as we all know who've ever seen Jurassic Park, it dealt with bringing back long dead, long extinct dinosaurs. De-extinction though, is that even possible? Bringing back creatures that have in the past become extinct. And if it is possible, is it something that we should realistically actually look at? Tamara Fletcher is a research associate in paleontology with the University of Queensland. Tamara, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us. Tamara, is it something that we should be looking at? How realistic is it that de-extinction is possible?
Well, look, it's a very complex issue, and there's definitely strong arguments on both sides, and I suppose that's why, you know, it's still something that we need to be discussing, and I think we need to be discussing more publicly. So it's been something scientists have been trying to do pretty much since cloning technology really looked possible. But there are multiple different ways of doing de-extinction, so each of those has its own concerns and possibilities.
So what would we be using? I'm presuming bones or fossils that have been found in the past?
What you need is anything that can provide you with DNA, and if you're using a cloning-like method of de-extinction, then you actually need an intact cell, a body cell. So something like bone tends to protect those kinds of cells from degradation better than other tissues, and that's why often we talk about looking at bones or tooth tissues to find those kinds of materials.
How many creatures that we've lost would we have examples of that present?
Well, that's a tough one. So the oldest DNA that's ever been found was 700,000 years, but that's a massive outlier. The best candidates at the moment are ones that we have frozen tissues from. So an Australian example is the gastric brooding frog. That's one that Mike Archer at UNSW is trying to bring back with the Lazarus Project, and they actually have frog tissue that's been in a freezer since they went extinct in the early 1980s.
We'll talk with Professor Mike Archer about that next, but right now I'm speaking with Tamara Fletcher, a research associate in paleontology with the University of Queensland, about this idea of de-extinction. If you're listening to this, what would you think about the prospect? Would it be great to see some of these creatures brought back? And if we have the ability, should we? Or could it open up a whole can of worms? 1300 222 891. You can also text us on 0467 922 891. I'm sure there are people who think that just because we can, maybe we should. But Tamara, I'm presuming that if we brought back some of these creatures into our ecosystems now, which have possibly changed since they were around, that it firstly could create a danger to these new alive creatures, and also perhaps to the other creatures that are around and not used to those sorts of creatures. So, you know, first of all, is that a realistic potential problem?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when we're considering de-extinction, you know, if and when we do develop the technology to be able to do it successfully, we're really going to have to think about this on a case-by-case basis for each animal or plant that we're wanting to bring back. So there's been some examples in the US of rewilding, which is taking a living animal from and reintroducing it into a region where it's become extinct, where they've seen that some of the herd animals aren't used to having wolves anymore and don't understand, and they've lost their fear of them, and that can decimate populations. But we've also seen reintroductions of wolves into environments where it's had unexpected and really, really positive consequences. So we need to know a lot about the animals before we go introducing them into an environment.
Mm. Because it would be a little bit pointless, wouldn't it, to bring them back only to have them become extinct again?
Oh, absolutely. We definitely, first and foremost, need to address the issues that caused them to become extinct in the first place. And if we haven't done that, then really it's quite a waste.
I mean, you can see that there would be benefits in other ways, that maybe it would allow for other creatures to survive because perhaps some other predators would go through this, but it also might put at risk some creatures that have been allowed to flourish since some of these go. It's all interlinked.
Yeah, sure. And some of the creatures that people are interested in bringing back have been gone for quite a while. So animals like the woolly mammoth have been gone for thousands of years. But they are doing sort of experiments in how reintroducing a lot of large herbivorous animals into the conditions that woolly mammoths used to live in is going to affect that environment. And in that case, there's even some suggestion that they need those woolly mammoths or at least grazing animals to re-enliven the biodiversity in those environments that are still suffering from the loss of grazing density that they once had up in Siberia.
Yeah. Just some of the texts that are coming through are talking about some of the things they'd like to see brought back. Rob suggests the dodo bird, which has also been long gone. I'm not sure that there's any evidence of that could be used to extract some DNA from Tamara?
Well, that's a difficult thing too. So animals that are better preserved are usually going to be found in quite cold and dry environments. So tropical animals that have gone extinct are going to be quite difficult to find those materials that we want with the kind of methods we're looking at.
What about closer to home? I mean, the Tasmanian tiger has long been talked about as being something that people would like to see again. Would that be possible?
That's a really good question, I think, for Mike Archer rather than for me.
Let's do that. Let's go to Professor Mike Archer, Professor of Environmental Science at the University of New South Wales. Professor, I know we are going to talk to you about the frog, but would it be possible to bring back the Tasmanian tiger, hypothetically?
Hi, Tamara. I, of course, am absolutely convinced that we can do this. We've already had a very interesting demonstration that with recovered ancient DNA from thylacines, from pickled Tasmanian tigers, Andrew Pask actually demonstrated that he can splice that DNA into a mouse genome with a tag on it that would demonstrate whether or not that DNA was working.
Now, hang on. So a thylacine tag on a mouse genome.
Yeah, it's an
That's completely
idea,
confused
it?
Me.
Well, DNA is DNA at the end of the day. There are obviously differences, and they're the signatures of individual animals. But the basic molecule enables pieces of it to be shifted into the genome of another animal, including us. We must remember we're not exactly pure organisms. Something probably like 15 or 20% of our DNA has been spliced into us by viruses that come from other organisms. So
Professor, if we brought it back then, though, we wouldn't be bringing it back in the same way. We'd be bringing back a version of it, wouldn't we?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And going back to your discussion about the mammoth,
there's
no pretense by the people who are doing this that they're expecting to have, if you like, 100% of the genetic identity of a mammoth in the animal that will eventually be put back into Siberia. But it will be an Asiatic elephant with many of the key genes that enabled the mammoth to survive in that kind of habitat. So in that case, where you're actually manipulating the DNA, you are working with an animal that is approximating the extinct animal. And for all practical purposes, you may not ultimately be able to tell them apart. But in the case of the kind of cloning we're doing with the gastric brooding frog, we're actually accepting that the whole genome is still intact. We're not messing with the DNA. We're kind of cheating in a way. And we're taking that whole nucleus with all of its DNA from the extinct animal's tissues and dropping that into an egg of a living relative. So in that case, the gastric brooding frog project, we're not actually playing with the DNA. We're accepting it the way it comes.
So would you have to have the basis of a genome that is very similar to the original creature, animal, whatever we're looking at in this?
I think that's a really good question. And a lot of this, as Tamara says, a lot of this is a bit of suck it and see. You need to sort of think about it carefully. But one of the delightful aspects about all this kind of research, which is sort of called synthetic biology generally, is that you often get outcomes that were impossible to predict. Like we now know that a lot of the cloned animals, for example, are actually going to live longer than other individuals of the same species. So you would want to start with an animal that was as close as possible to the extinct animal you're trying to revive. And in the case of the thylacine, a study that was done recently, they said they think that the closest living relatives are sufficiently close to expect that this probably could work. And in that case, what you might do is take, for example, the DNA of a Tasmanian devil. And with the recovered DNA from the thylacine, once you've read it, it's a recipe in effect, you go back to the Tasmanian devil's DNA and you change it. Those technologies are now very functional. And you change it to match the thylacine's DNA. And you do this in a cell line, and you don't sort of put it back into a uterus until you're pretty sure you got most of what you want. And then theoretically, what comes out the south end of a Tasmanian devil will be a thylacine.
Mm. It's an interesting concept we're talking about today, the process of de-extinction. Animals or creatures that have become extinct, could we, I guess in the vein of Jurassic Park or World, which is launching onto our screens this week, see creatures brought back to life in a way? What do you think about this idea? 1-300-222-891 is the phone number. You can also text us on 0467-922-891. Lorraine's given us a ring from Kidman Park. Hi, Lorraine.
Oh, hi, Sonia. Look, this discussion makes me angry? No, sad. It's almost like Disneyland we are creating. The habitat of these creatures they're talking about has been lost thousands of years ago, but we can't even protect the small bird species in the Adelaide Hills from dying out from lack of habitat, and the onward march of development into spaces that animals and birds and creatures are unique to Australia.
So are you saying you would prefer to see this money or technology used to protect those species we currently have from becoming extinct?
Definitely. We're losing species faster than any other time in history and any other place on Earth. And we have such a rich environment of species.
It's a fair point, Lorraine. Let me put that to Professor Mike Archer. Professor, is it worth spending money? And a couple of other texters have sort of pointed to this as well. Is it worth spending money on bringing back extinct species when what many people seem to think we need to do is to sort of stop the rot, in a sense?
Yeah, I completely agree, but I don't accept that it's either or, that we do one thing or the other. There's absolutely no reason why we can't be doing both. And in fact, the research, the activity research that's going on for some of these de-extinction projects, such as our gastric brooding frog, the Lazarus Project, involves developing a technique that is extremely important in trying to save endangered species today. For example, if you have two related species, one of which is endangered and one of which is doing okay, you can take the body cells from an endangered individual, and you can produce many individuals from the single endangered animal. You can increase the population sizes doing that sort of a thing. And this this is called somatic cell nuclear transfer. And to the extent that that technology can be developed, it becomes another powerful tool for aiding conservation of endangered species today. But I would also add that a lot of the money that's involved in these projects, these de-extinction projects that I'm aware of, and certainly the ones I'm involved with, is not money that would otherwise go to conserving living animals, because the people who produce this money don't have an interest in that area. They're really very interested in the technology. So the money has come laterally. This is not a zero-sum game. You can introduce new money to look at the technological skills and develop them, and then ideally use those skills to help conserve endangered species today. So it's not either or. I think we can do both.
Professor, how much does the reason for either extinction or endangerment play into this? My question, I guess, relates to the fact that if you bring back an extinct species or even an endangered one, trying to increase their numbers, and the reason that they've become or gotten to that point is because their habitat is reducing or, an outside factor is playing into that. Don't you need to solve that issue first to make sure that they have the best chances of survival once you do create them?
Again, I think there's a yes and a no to that question. Ideally, if it's about habitat loss, of course, we've got an issue. If one of the primary goals is to get the animal back into the wild again or the plant, then you've got to have the whale back there waiting to receive it again, and it's got to be an acceptable situation. As Tamara explained in putting the wolf back into Yellowstone Park, that actually restored that ecosystem. It's now working well again. In the case of the two projects I'm involved in, the thylacine went extinct not because its habitat was destroyed. There's plenty of habitat perfectly suitable for thylacines in Tasmania now. It went extinct because we shot it to death. We killed about 3,000 to 4,000 of them by 1930 and tipped it over the edge. In the case, so if we stopped shooting them, and we could put them back into that habitat, and I've spoken to people who actually caught thylacines when they were kids, they took me back to the places where they'd actually caught them, and they said the habitat is exactly the way they remember it when they were a child.
Mm.
In the case of the gastric brooding frog, what took that animal out was almost certainly the chytrid fungus, and that's something humans introduced to the environment when we brought in African clawed frogs into Australia for reproductive studies.
Can you explain
but
to
we
us
can control that.
Explain to us a little bit more about the Lazarus Project and what it is doing.
Well, the gastric brooding frog is a fascinating animal. It became famous as soon as it was discovered in the 70s because it swallowed its fertilized eggs. And the full development of these frogs, from the tadpole stage to the metamorphosis into small frogs, all occurred in the female's stomach. And then she jettisoned the fully formed frogs out of her mouth. And when biologists, of course, saw that, they were absolutely gobsmacked. And the medical researchers were interested, how did this animal convert its stomach into effectively a uterus? But just as everybody got excited about it, it went extinct. And we think it went extinct because this chytrid fungus was introduced to the environment. Now, what we've tried to do, we worked with tissues that Mike Tyler, who was a professor in the University of Adelaide, had stored nearly 40 years ago in his deep freezer. And we found that that tissue actually has intact nuclei, which contains the DNA, still in it. So that was the source of the material we've been using to take those nuclei and put them into the eggs of a distant but related frog whose nuclei has been removed. So we're creating hybrid cells, but the only DNA that's in those cells, and that's the goal here, is to be the gastric brooding frog. Now, at this point, we know we have the gastric brooding frog DNA back and working. It's building cells, so we're over the biggest hump that we thought we would have to struggle with. What we're now trying to do is get the early-stage embryos to continue to develop into a tadpole, and that's the next series of challenges. I'm working with people in the University of Newcastle and Melbourne University and even Mongolia. We have an interesting team of experts trying to solve all these problems, and we hope eventually get the gastric brooding frog back. But to answer your question, if we're going to put it back, we have to deal with that chytrid fungus that's probably still waiting in the environment.
Yes.
To do that, we think we'll be able to use resistance genes that frogs are developing around the world, in some cases, to that fungus. If we can identify the gene, splice it into the gastric brooding frogs that we're reconstructing, then theoretically we can put it back and it will be immune to that fungus.
So we can, the possibility of us creating these creatures is definitely there, but the rewilding thing sounds a little bit more complicated.
Well, it just needs thought, as Tamara said. This is not something you just do willy-nilly.
Mm.
In the case of the mammoth one, it's an interesting thing, going back on the discussion you had there, one of the fascinating rationales that the Russians have been using is to point out that one of the biggest problems we have in Siberia today, where the mammoth used to be very commonly, whenever the glaciers pulled back, the mammoths moved into the country. When the glaciers expanded, they moved south. So it's now a reduced glacial condition. Mammoths could be put back there and be perfectly suitable for them. Their argument is that what that would also do is reestablish the balanced ecosystem that will slow the release of frozen methane that is in the Siberian tundra. These are called clathrates, and they're about 30 times more powerful than normal greenhouse gases. And everybody is quite scared about what happens as these giant masses of methane just bubble up through what is a very thin layer of soil. They argue if they can get mammoths back and woolly rhinos and a range of other things, they can insulate that better than is occurring at the moment and slow the release of that methane into the atmosphere.
Fascinating. Professor, look, thank you for joining us with this discussion today. Professor Mike Archer is a professor of Environmental Science, University of New South Wales. And we also thank Tamara Fletcher, Research Associate in Paleontology with the University of Queensland.